Mr. Caldwell, you're a great man.
Now, all I gotta do is to pull this plug
out of the wall.
Come right in, Sergeant.
Careful, men. Careful, careful. That must be the kid. But he don't look so tough to me.
Well, he got a little soft.
Oh, there'll be no more complaints, officer. I guess I can go on where Mr. Caldwell left off.
Caldwell, you're wanted. This time you either answer some questions or we'll keep you in the cooler till you do.
What, in jail? Oh, okay, let's go.
Hey, wait a minute. You act like you wanted to go to jail.
Yeah, I do. I got a feeling it'll be safer there.
What do you mean?
Just put me away till a certain party leaves town. I'll confess to anything.
Okay, then, Caldwell. Into the paddy wagon you go.
Thanks, officer. You may be saving my life. Now, if you just help me carry this logic out...
Wait a minute. You can't take that in the wagon.
I can't. Why not?
No room. We've already got a dame in there who's raising the roof.
A dame?
Yeah, a blonde. She was trying to buy a gun without a permit. She keeps screaming she's going to miss her date with Ducky.
You have just heard another adventure into the unknown world of the future. The world of... Dimension X.
Next week, Dimension X joins the big parade of exciting half-hour presentations at a brand new time. On Friday evenings at a different hour. In the Eastern time zone, you'll hear it at 9 o'clock Fridays, daylight saving time. In other zones, please consult your local newspaper listings to learn the new time. For that's when Dimension X will bring you one of the strangest stories ever told. Ray Bradbury's Mars is Heaven.
Tonight's story on Dimension X was titled A Logic Named Joe, written by Murray Leinster and adapted for radio by Clarice A. Ross. Featured in the cast were Joseph Julian as Frank and Roger DeCoven as the Logic. Your narrator was Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman. Engineer Don Albert. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Edward King. Robert Warren speaking. Tomorrow, hear a thrilling story on high adventure. It's on NBC.
Would you believe me if I told you that this is the NBC radio network? I certainly hope not. Because that would be very foolish. Because you know this is WBAI. In New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. If you join the Hour of the Wolf Facebook group, and I know that everybody listening has done that, right? If you have joined the Hour of the Wolf Facebook group, you will have seen and taken note of the fact that I wrote on there very clearly that I would not be on tonight because of transmitter maintenance. Apparently, we all believed that. Robert Knight believed it, so Max got to play A Logic Named Joe by Murray Leinster. Now, well, I'll get back to that in just a moment, but... And then he got to do 3 hours last night, and he played Gene Shepherd and all that. And it's like, hey, guess what, guys? In a moment, I posted that on Facebook, by the way. Janet Coleman calls me on my mobile phone and says, are you sure you're not on? I said, yeah, we got that memo. She said, I don't know. So I called Tony Ryan, and he said, yes, there is transmitter maintenance tonight. Yes, the transmitter will go off. Should be for about 2.5 minutes. For that, we have preempted about 16 hours this week. So I came in. Now, usually, third Wednesday of every month, I dutifully would want to go to the KGB Fantastic Fiction readings. But I am a lucky person. Gordon Linsner is very, very kind. I gave him my old recorder after I had bought myself a new recorder. And he has been recording all of the readings for me because they're great. And just to prove it, this week and next, actually having nothing to do with the fact that they are the KGB readings, we have the two proprietors of that series, Matt Kressel, and next week, Ellen Datlow. The reason Datlow is coming on is because it's Datlow, okay? I mean, she's done the show even more than Matt. And Matt, as member of groups, plural, well, part of a panel once on different versions of Philip K. Dick adaptations of one novel, which was my second show in this time slot and was a great show. And outside of that, with his writer's group, Altered Fluids, which we have not done an episode of in like 2 years. And this, yeah, it's been 2 years, Matt. Yeah. Pull one of those microphones close to you. And I will turn it on and say really again.
Really?
There we go. Much better. It's been like at least 2 years since I recorded one. And then it took me about 2 months. Okay, a year and a half?
That sounds more.
It was in
more accurate.
Okay. You know what I would say? I would say a year ago last October.
We need to do it again.
Yes, I was coming around to that.
Yeah.
Regular listeners know what we're talking about. Altered Fluid is this dynamic, dynamic means always changing. This brilliant group of mostly young writers, except they went around the bend and got the wonderful Rick Bowes, who was here 2 weeks ago, you know, so that the average age of everybody went up by a year or something. And the listen, Rick would have made a much worse joke than I just did. You know it.
We are all young writers.
They are all young writers.
Young in spirit, at least.
And even Rick is a young writer because he writes. He's brilliant.
He's very prolific.
He really is. Mm-hmm. He belongs to both that writer's group and to the Tabula Rasa writer's group, formerly known as the 8th of February. I prefer the name 8th of February writer's group because that was birth date of Jules Verne.
Ah.
That's why they called it that. And when Bill Shun left the group and he, with Bob Howe, was the founder of it, they thought, well, if Shun is gone, they had to change the name of the group. And they called it Tabula Rasa because nobody uses that name. I found a bad science fiction movie called Tabula Rasa. Mm-hmm. I found four novels, science fiction novels, called Tabula Rasa, which is funny that they should all be science fiction because it just means blank slate in Latin.
Right.
So I think they should that the Tabula Rasa should have written on it February 8th. But anyway, so Rick belongs to both groups. And but the Altered Fluid group has about 12 members, 11 members.
We have about 10 active members and.
And a couple of
satellites. A couple satellite members.
Yeah. Because they're not just alumni, because at least E.C. Myers, Eugene Myers, participates by phone
we
usually.
We consider him an active member. He Skypes in quite a bit, or, you know, we do video conferencing with him for our critiques. So, you know, and he's not that far away. He's in Philly, so he shows up every couple of weeks.
He was at KGB
tonight.
Yeah. I tried to coerce him here, but he had already bought his train ticket. No offense that you were second. But Eugene doesn't get here often.
That's right.
I figure out-of-towners trump New Yorkers.
Absolutely, as they should.
Yeah. It's, you know, because I have fewer opportunities to get the out-of-towners in here. And Eugene is a great guest and has turned out to be quite the fine and successful, damn him, novelist.
Yes.
His
Fair Coin.
His Fair Coin.
Fair Coin and Quantum Coin.
Have done very well.
Very well. And he's working on a couple new ones, he told me tonight.
Yeah, these are young adult novels. I was going to say quantum adult novels.
I don't know if I should say, so I won't. But he's working on a couple things. A couple new things.
Cool.
Not related to Fair Coin and Quantum Coin.
Yeah. Not necessarily YA either.
Correct. I will leave it up to Eugene to announce.
Yes, when next he comes on this program, which actually he and I made, he's coming to the KGB reading in August. He told me. I'm not guessing.
Well, oh, I thought you meant he's reading. No, yeah, he's...
No, he's attending.
Right, right.
I am ashamed to say I don't know I don't know who either of those writers are.
Mm-hmm. Both YA authors.
Okay, and he specifically wanted to attend, so he said that, and I happen to know that Gordon Linsner, who has been helping me out so much by recording the KGB readings, mm-hmm. cannot do it in August for reasons I don't know, but he sent me an email, so I will go record that, then Eugene will be the guest here. So at that time, maybe he can make an announcement.
Okay.
Maybe. It's a few months from now, right. So. Hopefully everything will have, you know, worked out with his agent and publishers and everything like that. We can only hope. At any rate, so Altered Fluid, as a group, it used to be that they would come here live at 5 in the morning. But what we do now is we go to a space that they normally meet in, mm-hmm. which occasionally changes depending on people's availability of office space or...
Right now we're meeting at a rehearsal space.
Yeah.
Because office space is unavailable.
Yeah. How's the echo there?
The echo there... Well, I don't think we've ever done an audio recording there.
I'm going to have to
That's broadcast quality.
I think I'm going to have to bring two mics. So that...
There's a lot of background noise because it is a rehearsal space. So you hear people singing and music, and there's pianos in the room, and
we had
screaming sometimes.
We had a Nursef reading.
Yeah.
That's the other reading series, and this is the one that I curate, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We had a Nursef reading in which the space that we're supposed to be in, John Ordover, was booked. And Ordover actually went out of his way to book us a space, and he found a rehearsal space right across the street from the public theater. It mm-hmm. was really cool. But the funniest thing in the world is that there was a small rehearsal room right next to ours. We had Charlie Jane Anders.
Mm-hmm.
And no, that was the other one where we were bounced out. No, we had, we had two great writers, both from California. No, one from England, one from California.
Are you thinking of Alex Daly McFarlane?
No.
No?
No, we had Deborah. My mind is mush. It has been a difficult day. Deborah, who's written like only about 15 novels, some of them rock and roll, some of them murder mysteries based on old Scottish ballads. And then we had this wonderful transgender writer, not Charlie Jane Anders, the British woman who writes a lot of poetry and novels and won like the Clark Award last year. I mean, good people. Good.
Okay.
One way or the other. In the middle of the reading, in this big space, we're hearing noise from next door. And there were these little girls belting. They were rehearsing. They were trying out for and or rehearsing for Matilda.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, something out of 42nd Street, you know.
We hear that every week.
Oh, no. You don't get anything like 42nd Street. You get more like the Ridiculous Theater Company with Charles Ludlam or something. You, the people upstairs at KGB are like clog dancers.
Oh, no, we hear some...
Good theater?
Good singers, quite good, and usually just doing the long tones, just holding tones for as long as possible.
Okay. All I know is that tonight,
yeah.
you know, Elia Don Johnson's reading was just fine, you know. But the moment that Rick Bowes gets up on stage to start reading, first, Terrence Taylor's iPhone goes off, and he had a special attachment on it that was blocking
right.
one of the buttons on the phone because he was using his iPhone as a movie camera, so he couldn't turn it off.
But there's always something. We always
then there was a special series of sirens and
who was it when we had the cheerleader? The cheerleaders outside doing some kind of routine during someone's reading.
I was there.
It was a few months ago. I don't remember.
It was like the last one I was at, in fact.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why.
Was that Brian Keene or no? Was that earlier than that?
No, because the one I was at, and I wasn't at Brian Keene. So...
Was that Helen Marshall or Jack Ketchum?
Yes.
It was?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was during Dallas's.
It was during Jack's, yeah.
It was during Jack Ketchum's bit.
Yeah, and he was fine.
He just kept going. He's a trooper. But you see, I'm sitting there recording, thinking, hey, I can put this on Hour of the Wolf.
You can or you can't?
Well, normally, I was thinking, like tonight, I could certainly put Elias on Hour of the Wolf. Rick's reading, not so much.
No, not with the sirens. Right?
And he read so bleeping well when he was on the show 2 weeks ago.
Oh, he's a great reader.
Yes, but when he's in a studio alone, without an audience, he has a tendency, I hope you're not listening, Rick. I know he is, because Ellen will tell him to. He read too fast.
Tonight?
No, 2 weeks ago, when he was live on the show.
Okay.
On this show. Tonight,
I like fast readers.
We disagree.
We disagree?
It won't be the first time.
It depends on who's reading. Certain readers... Their pacing, if they're faster,
okay.
Somehow I get more engrossed in the story.
Fine. No argument. Yeah, you noticed that. It depends on the story. I believe that when somebody is reading for the radio or for an audiobook or something like that, that you are storytelling.
Yes.
I believe that the first thing that when somebody comes up to our reading series, and you read for us not long ago.
Yes.
Because I always believe in co-opting the competition. I had one reading where I had, where Paul Witkover was the curator for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and he went to read at KGB, and I was just apoplectic. It's like, how dare you? So I booked Gavin Grant and Kelly Link to read.
Yes, you one-upped the KGB series.
Yeah, absolutely. You steal mine, I steal you. Right. And in their case, all of you. And I had Datlow introduce them. So, you know, that's revenge. But
we need to have Paul back, actually, at KGB.
He read for us about 3 months ago, and he is... good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He is very good. I have to have him on the air again as well because he's also an astute critic of movies, of literature. He really follows the genres and he follows a lot of stuff I don't.
Right.
He'd be an interesting choice. Or Hour of the Wolf
2.0. 2.0?
Yes. This is a real thing that I'm thinking of in my head. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a radio show, if it's a podcast, or what. But 90 minutes isn't enough. I'm greedy. So 2.0 means that I will have more people doing bits. I've had some movie reviews from Genevieve Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
I want YA reviews, young adult reviews, from Elia Dawn Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad choice. Tech reviews from, God help me, Tempest Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want somebody who's willing to take a look at a phone and analyze it by saying, this thing sucks. She will not hesitate from saying that, you know, instead of all these and the thing is, she's also very good.
Oh, absolutely. I was actually Googling phones recently because I need to get a new phone.
Right.
And I was reading an article. I'm like, oh, this is well-written, very informative article. And then I realized that she had written it, and I wasn't specifically looking for posts from her. And
it wasn't
Kay
Tempest Bradford. It was probably Kim T. Bradford, wasn't it?
I think it was just K. Bradford.
Okay.
Yeah, it might be K. T. Bradford, I think, yeah.
Oh, it might be K.T. But she uses...
Yeah. But I recognize...
Like E.M. N. Banks versus Ian Banks, you know, uses slight variants to keep those personalities
sad
distinct.
You heard about,
We'll have to tell listeners. Ian Banks, is it a brain tumor? It's something horrible.
Yeah.
I just blocked out what it is.
Yeah, there's been a lot of bad news in the going around lately?
I do not. I use Gmail. I have my ourwolf.com lives on SFFnet.
Mm-hmm.
But because their webmail, they're a good service, but their webmail is, well, shall we say, a bit primitive. So I have it forwarded to Gmail. So I use it on my phone. I use it in my computer. Fine. But if I go to webmail, because I do have to look through my spam to make sure there are no diamonds in the rough, they have roses. They will post a rose, and next to that rose, they will put the name of a person who has died or something like that. And that rose has been showing up too freaking often in the last few months for my taste.
Yeah.
I was once live on the air and starting a show, and I had to check something in email, and so I went there and I saw my friend Jack Chalker, mm-hmm. who I was pretty close friends with. He and I traveled to conventions together and shared rooms and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And you go on there and and live on the air, I find out that he dies. I mean, this is just like, I have issues with mortality. I don't like it.
I don't think you're the exception. I don't think anyone likes mortality, especially their own. And especially with all the stuff going on in the news lately, just being reminded of it is hard for people. It's interesting, though. In some ways, I find contemplating your own mortality, my own mortality, is kind of a motivator to say, all right, we have a limited time on this earth. Let me do what I need to do. Stop procrastinating. And
I'm a horrible procrastinator.
There's
a movie about my procrastination out on the web.
Yours specifically?
Yes, me specifically.
What is this movie?
It was made by Cesar Bustamante, who also made
Cesar, of course, yeah.
He made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 4.5 minutes long. He also did a short film on Terrence Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is like a week old.
It came out last week?
Yes.
How come I haven't heard of this?
Because you weren't on my page on Facebook, maybe.
Oh, well, I mean, I scroll down. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, go to my.
Yeah, okay.
If you go to my page on Facebook, it is basically about my tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Max is mentioned in it, and in fact, I wanted them to interview Max. That's Max Schmidt, because Max is...
You're talking about your archive in your basement?
Yes.
Okay, yes.
Yes, that's it. My cassettes, they never did get into the interview, just how much work Max had to do to get my Ray Bradbury interview from 2000 on mm-hmm. the air for Bradbury's 90th birthday.
Just because the tapes were so old?
I was only 11 years old. I have 45-year-old tapes that are in perfect condition. But this 11-year-old tape...
So you've been doing Hour of the Wolf for how many years?
1972, and this is 2013.
So you have nearly every show archived?
No.
Not every show?
No, not at all. Because if I just go on the air alone...
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, now I will take the archive right off the internet, right off archive.wbai.org.
But back when it was reel-to-reel.
But back to when it was reel-to-reel, it would take 2 10-inch reels
mm-hmm.
to archive one episode of me blathering on the
was
air
that
and
3 hours,
phone calls.
An hour and a half?
No, there's 2 hours.
2 hours, okay.
2 hours. Each 10-inch reel is 1 hour. At 7.5 inches per second. We did not use cassettes. Later on, we used cassettes, and even then, it would be 3 sides of a cassette.
Mm-hmm.
C90s. You never use C120s because the tape is too thin.
Right.
So the 90-minute cassettes, and people use cassettes, mind you, don't use the 120s. They will curl around the capstan on your machine, and you will cry. Just use C90s. they're also cheaper. And but they're thicker tape. They're like three quarters of a millimeter as opposed to one quarter of a millimeter, which is why they're so much better.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I have these reel. I wouldn't bother to air check a show that's just me blathering on. If I had a guest, then I air check it. Mm-hmm. Because that, you know, George Alec Effinger walks in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm going to air check that. I'm going to air check the show that I had Clifford D. Simak on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, duh. I'm so glad that I did. He was such a wonderful guest. Frank Herbert, Le Guin,
you.
But for just me taking phone calls about God knows what, to devote how much tape? With how much storage to that? And the show was on 5 days a week.
And did you have guests every day?
No, no. I guess maybe once or twice a week.
Okay.
I'm quite used to doing the show alone. People think, who's your guest tonight? Just me.
Just you.
Yeah, very often in those days. Now that I have 90 minutes a week, I feel different.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when I had a kids' show on Saturday mornings called Kinderfantasiegeschichten, which is one word meaning children's science fiction. I was producing a 5-hour comedy show of the Family Electric Theater on Wednesday nights. I had Hour of the Wolf at that point only 3 days a week, but I was producing the other two episodes of that other people did. Joan Hervey and Richard Fioravanti and some other people did single shows, and I was theoretically the executive producer of those. So I was responsible for about 20 hours a week of radio.
Right.
Now I get 90 minutes and not quite the same kind of a time slot, so...
So what are we going to do tonight for our...
We're doing it.
56 minutes...
Let us... First, introduce you. Aside from being co-host, co-producer, I use the word curator.
Co-curator is fine.
I like curator. I don't remember where.
Co-curator.
I'm the one who like made that stick, but I didn't.
Curator
it's
is more to the point than a co-host, I think.
Yeah.
Co-curator.
Because I am the executive curator of my reading series,
mm-hmm.
but my next reading will be hosted by Ron Hogan.
Right.
And he co-curated. Actually, no, he curated that one. I chose him. He chose the readers.
Mm-hmm.
I had to cancel his because he chose somebody that you had reading 2 months later.
Okay.
Leanna.
Oh.
Leanna Renee Heber, who will be reading with Evie Mangieri, who's a new writer from Tor Books, who, when he told me her name, I Googled it up, and it's like, yes, she sounds very interesting. And, oh, did Ellen Wright pull a number on me? I was going to take the summer off, and Ellen Wright just came up with these writers. I can't take the summer off anymore.
No. You could just let someone else host.
Whenever you see... Let Ellen host.
Yeah, why not?
Well, I'll tell you why not, because she's a PR person for a publishing company.
Gavin was co-curator for a while of KGB, and he was publisher.
He's a publisher. It's a little different somehow. And, you know, that's the whole argument right there with Kelly Link, you know, was she self-published or not? And
oh, no, yet, she was. I mean, but...
She was, yes, it, but... It's a big...
But it worked for her because, well, quite frankly, she's just amazingly talented and no one really noticed.
Yeah.
But
quick story about self-publishing.
Yeah.
Charles Ardai, A-R-D-A-I, lovely guy, married to the amazing Naomi Novik.
Mm-hmm.
Charles once had an idea of cheap free internet that he called Juno.com, and he founded that company. And then he sold it, so he's a billionaire. But what of that? What does he do? Well, he publishes his own publishing company called Hard Case.
Oh, yes, Detective. I know. Yes, yes, yes.
Very prestigious, very good.
I didn't know he started Juno.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, look him up on Wikipedia. He's an interesting guy. He mm-hmm. really is. And also mm-hmm. just a sweet, nice person that either you or I should have reading
yeah.
at our series, even mm-hmm. if he's the wrong genre. It doesn't matter.
Right.
But, you know, have him and Naomi together. That would be a good pairing.
Yes.
Yeah, it would.
We I don't think Naomi read for us since I've been co-curating the KGB series. It was the last time she read was a while ago.
She read for us at the South Street Seaport, and she read for you once since. It may have been not long after you came on board.
Oh, you know what? You're right. She did read while I was there.
Yeah.
She did. You're right. May 20th, 2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that also means she's due for one of us.
It's been so long.
Yeah, well, she's been busy.
Yeah.
She's turning out those Temeraire novels and other stuff on the side, not to be discussed. But at any and she's written video games. That's actually how she met Charles, is that they're both video game writers. They worked in Neverwinter Nights 2.
Mm.
But at any rate, Charles writes good hard case mystery novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I have the story correct. The story is basically that he sold it successfully to a good publisher, a major publisher. And he said, great, when's it coming out? And they said, well, in about 3.5 years, because they're, you know, it's mystery. And they were publishing a title a month, even worse than science fiction, which often publishers give two titles a month. So it was like, I don't want to wait that long. He had his own publishing company. So even though he had sold the book professionally,
mm-hmm.
he decided, I can put this book out in 6 months and give it a cover I approve, et cetera, et cetera. Book does fabulously, gets great reviews in various places, nominated for an Edgar Award, and then called ineligible because it was self-published. Now, that sucks.
Yeah.
Because he had already sold the damn thing to brand name company. He mm-hmm. just didn't want the...
That's a shame.
It really is.
Yeah.
The problems of self-publishing. So aside from being co-curator, co-producer, co-host, co-person at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series third Wednesday of every month at the KGB Bar at 84 East 4th Street.
That sounds marginally correct.
4th Street.
I should know the address.
4th Street just west of 2nd Avenue.
85 East 4th
85
Street.
85 East 4th. Just west of 2nd Avenue. Second floor. You're a writer.
Yes.
You have published any number of fine short stories. You have had podcasts produced of them, and you have also, knock wood, longer works to be published sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm. My most recent short story that's out was in Lightspeed in January, Lightspeed Magazine. Edited by John Joseph Adams, and the story is called "The Sounds of Old Earth," and it had quite a good reception. Joyce Carol Oates happened to read it. And she tweeted that how much she loved it, and I was really flattered by that.
Oh my God, that is, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think she follows Ellen. So I have Ellen Datlow to thank for this.
I know that Ellen has bought Joyce Carol Oates' stories.
Yeah, and so I tweeted that my story was out, and Ellen retweeted it, and I guess Joyce Carol Oates must have read the story, and that really made my New Year's Day.
I would think, yeah.
And it's really got I've.
By the way, full disclosure: I am now on the masthead of Lightspeed Magazine. For what that's worth. But I'm not in an editorial position, so it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Or rather, I edit. which is to say I actually edit. I'm a digital editor of podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Replacing somebody in altered fluid.
Yes, Mr. Rajan Khanna.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Who also has narrated a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
And has a very good speaking voice.
But I have no idea why he's not. I'm not sure. I actually have a very good idea why.
But we were.
It pays bupkis.
Yeah.
But you see.
We won't talk about remuneration.
No, it's not an issue of remuneration. I'll say one thing. I don't think that his career path is as an audio person in science fiction, and I think that is my career path.
Okay.
That's a guess.
Well, we were talking before you and I had a second dinner, you know, like the hobbits second breakfast. We had second dinner.
11s.
Yes.
Except 11 p.m.s.
Yeah, and we were talking about Stephen Rudnicki. I hope I'm pronouncing
Stephen.
It. Stephen Rudnicki. Narrated the podcast of my story, The Sounds of Old Earth. And first of all, I thought that he did an amazing job.
He has quite a voice.
Blew me away. And it was after I heard him read the story, and the narrator in my story is an older person.
He does dialects beautifully as well.
He has this deep kind of
rolling
voice. And after I heard him narrate the podcast, I could no longer think of my protagonist Abner without hearing Stefan's voice,
which is a good and a bad thing.
To me, it speaks to the power of his narration, the way he was really able to capture that character.
No, I mean, it's the fact that it is a great performance that in its way is almost, I want to say insidious, because here I am, a person who tries to bring audio science fiction mm-hmm. to the air.
Right.
But I do my share of readings and all that. But having said that, the best voice is the voice and image is the voice and image of the mind's eye.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you can't read a book when you're driving home on the freeway. You can listen to it, though.
That's right. I mean, you were saying before that you could, you know, we were talking about the speed that someone reads.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to say was that reading is a form of acting. You're acting out your characters' voices, and when I say acting, and when you're reading your own work, when you're trying to bring it alive, you have to put in a little. Your own voice obviously comes out in the reading, but you have to add more to it, an emphasis, I think, that makes a really strong reading. And the people who have trained as actors and actresses, like Liana, for example, just do amazing jobs when they do readings. And, you know, James Patrick Kelly, Jim Kelly, I believe, did some training.
Sense.
As an actor, and that he's just like he comes up there and he has that presence, and wow, does he capture your attention? You know, I've heard authors read who don't really have a whole lot of emotion coming out in their voice. They're not doing a lot of emotive emphasis in the characters' voices, but the stories are so powerful, you're drawn in anyway.
Yeah. But you see, I do training for authors.
Okay.
Every time I can at ReaderCon, at Capclave, and I did one last year. I am so annoyed and sorry, but I have with me now that I missed Althea Contis at mm-hmm. KGB. Because
she was great, too.
She was one of my students.
Okay. Well, she
I spent four.
Had a great stage
I spent,
presence.
I
Both of them did that night. That was a fantastic night. Did you air that on your show?
Not yet, because I only got the
tape.
The SD card tonight.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Gordon, when he's been recording them, is using my old recorder. It's all the readings.
Alethea Contis and Leanna Renee Heber.
That's right. And yes. We're having Leanna next month.
Next month.
But Althea, well, Leanna's a professional actress.
Yes.
I mean, she was doing that before she was writing.
Mm-hmm.
This is like her skill set. She's there. Althea.
I think is it Alethea?
Alethea.
Alethea.
Sorry. Alethea.
Yeah.
Is a writer. She signed up for a course that I was giving at last year's Nebula Awards.
Okay. Well, she definitely.
Not that she would have been terrible had she not taken my class.
Well, she was good.
But she was. I have photographs of her during that class. I was flattered at the attention she gave.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot to say to writers about reading on the air. I will claim credit. I will claim some credit for some of the improvement in Rick Bowes over the years.
Okay.
And
we'll see what he says about that.
He gives me the credit. As
he
well.
Does?
He
okay.
does. He does. He does. Especially on his reading of There's a Hole in the City.
Oh, well, that's a great reading.
That is a great reading. And that's me directing and producing and all that. And I used a trick on him.
What's that?
That worked very well. There comes a time, and this is a problem that I think a lot of writers have when they are reading their own work, that they will have a tendency to move over certain things and talk a little bit too quickly over it and maybe not give it all the emphasis because they know the material too
well. Right.
And the fact is, there's a certain, I'll say almost shyness about the fact that this is their own work that they're putting out there. And it's like, I did this, I don't know how it is. I mean, all performers and writers who are performers in a way, are a little bit insecure about what they're doing. I don't care how many Tony Awards and Academies they've done. Mm-hmm. Insecurity is part of the package.
Right.
And if you've written it, it's that much worse. So one of the tricks that I've used with some writers is I would tell Rick Bowes, knowing who one of his favorite writers is I want you to read that same paragraph that you just did, only I want you to be aware of the fact that this story was written by Jeff Ford. Now, Jeff Ford is a great writer. And telling that to somebody
like Rick. One of my favorite writers.
Yeah, one of my favorites, too. The point being that now this writer, in this case Rick Bowes, he sells it better. He's no longer reading his own work, even though it is. Even though it is, There's a Hole in the City or whatever. He's selling it more. He realized that, oh, I'm promoting the writing of Cage Baker or whomever, one of his favorite writers. And all of a sudden, he's got to sell it. He's more likely to sell somebody else's work, a writer. Let's get away from Rick. A writer is more likely to sell somebody else's work.
So you're saying if writer, you know, John Smith is reading his own work, but he
might gloss over it.
He admires writer, you know, Mary Jones.
Mm-hmm.
He should emulate Mary Jones's style when he's reading his own work.
Not emulate her style.
Imagine himself style. As if
she wrote it.
As if she wrote it. Okay.
He should perform it. He should perform it his own way as if it's a work that she had written.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden the ego of, I wrote this. How are people going to accept the prose? Will they like this character? All of that is taken away because now Mary Jones, this
interesting
person's
to take
favorite
the ego
writer.
Out of it. You take yourself out of it, so you shift the insecurity away from yourself.
Exactly.
Interesting. I like that.
That's one of the techniques.
Yeah.
that I use in helping writers give better performances.
I'll have to try that next time. I'm not really sure what, I mean, I guess I'm...
Name a favorite writer.
Well, I love Jeff. Jeff's one of my favorites.
Well, okay, that's a good one.
Yeah, you know, Kelly Link, always, her readings always astonish me.
You know what I would suggest for you?
Who?
This is a weird one. Isaac Bashevis Singer.
That's weird that you just said that. That's weird that you just said that because I was thinking that before.
Ha!
Right when you were talking...
My ego just went, ha!
Yeah, that's weird. And actually, I just finished In My Father's Court. It's a series of memoirs.
Oh, I haven't read that.
About his life as a boy. His father was a...
See, I know and admire your fiction, and so my guess would be that you have...
Oh, Singer's a big influence on some of my more recent stories.
Uh-huh.
And in My Father's Court, he's a boy. It's memoirs of his life growing up in Poland in the 20s, and his father is... basically the judge for the town, and people would come with all sorts of problems. They want a divorce, or someone stole something, or, you know, is it kosher if I spilled a little milk in the meat, and it's the only meat we have for the Sabbath, and do we throw
Will
it
God
out and
understand?
Starve?
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, someone shows up at his door and says, is it okay, Rabbi, to sleep with the dead body? And the rabbi's like, what are you talking about? And it turns out that... his wife has died, and then his apartment's infested with rats, and he doesn't want to put the wife on the floor because she'll be eaten, and then he can't stay awake to sleep on the floor himself.
That is so Singer-like.
But it was true. This is all true stuff.
Wow.
Or true, in quotes.
Yeah.
You know, memoirs, of course. You add your own flavors, and, you know, this is stuff that he was writing about decades after. So, but... you could see if you read the memoirs and then you look at his fiction again.
But you see, I don't want just somebody that when I say to you, you should think of blah blah. It shouldn't be just somebody you admire. It should be somebody who's like almost godlike. Because and Singer to me,
yes,
it's just Borges, Singer,
Right? Oh yeah, no, he's probably my favorite writer, I would say.
What are your favorite stories? His stories.
The Gentleman from Krakow, I think.
Okay. I have one that is probably a weird one. Just cause...
Oh, The Cafeteria I read recently, and that's just... It's mind-blowing how... Like, what I love about Singer's stories is how the fantastic... creeps in suddenly, not creeps in, but jumps in suddenly and then withdraws and then it's mundane again and then it comes back and it's just so effortless how he just switches between the fantastic and the mundane.
Yeah. The story I'm thinking of is just that I happen to like. I'm not saying this is like Singer's great story. I just happen to love it. Is Yachid and Yachida. Which you must be familiar with the anthology Wandering Stars,
yes,
by Jack Dann.
Yes, yes, yes.
It was reprinted in there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the story about these angels. And basically when they die, as it were, they are born on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So the...
You know, I read that anthology and I'm not sure why that story's not ringing a bell with me. Oh, wait, no, I did read that. Wait a minute. Was that where they go to, like, the heavenly gates?
And... Mm-hmm.
That one is intense.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. It's a very intense. It's being told in the terms of a tragedy.
Yeah.
But it's actually because we have a point of view,
mm-hmm,
that our protagonists, who are these angels, these, mm-hmm, unborn, these life forces that are waiting to be born on Earth,
mm-hmm,
we know that their, quote, death begins their life on Earth. So what is a tragedy to them is wonderful,
right,
for
it's,
us.
That's right. That's what I liked about it, was that the whole... there was a reverse metaphor. Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Like, yeah, hell to them was
yeah,
what we live in, what we... Yeah.
You know, the last line being something the grave and the grave digger have met.
Yes.
And joy be unto them.
Yes, that is actually quite a piece of work.
Yeah. Pardon me. I have to prop the door open so that Lister, with the show that follows, we have to, like, just prop the door. We open this door and it makes noise. But I know you got to get in here to set up. Lister, this is Matthew.
Hey.
Oh, yeah, you guys have met before. Yeah, probably more like that. Matthew's often en masse. Yeah, so...
We're talking about Singer's stories.
Nahida.
Yes.
But that was just but one story. I mean, other I love that anthology. It's one of my favorite anthologies.
Yeah, there's two of them, right? Wandering Stars,
There's three, but two in print.
Two in print,
there's
okay.
Wandering Stars, more Wandering Stars, and I think in Australia only, and only for like a day, there was even more.
Uh-huh.
I wish you would do more, because I know you would have stories to go in there. I know Barbara Krasnoff.
Well, there's the anthology, The People of the Book. Did you see
that about two years ago?
I was in
it.
That one. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I liked that one.
Well, it was the same general idea.
Except for the fact that the editor was looking for themes.
Editors.
The editors.
Rachel Swirsky and Sean Wallace.
Yeah. There were... We'll talk off air.
Okay.
But anyway, all that aside... Yeah. I can practically name the stories of Wandering Stars without, you know, having seen a copy in a year. Look, You Think You've Got Troubles by Carol Carr. The Jewbird by Bernard Malamud.
Yes.
Oh my God, that is a great, weird, bizarre story about anti-Semitism within Semitics.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for Kadak by Harlan Ellison, which mm-hmm. we produced a author's reading of, which is one of the best readings Harlan has ever given, and that's not a light statement. The Dybbuk of Mazel Tov 4 by Robert Silverberg.
Uh-huh.
I mean, great, wonderful stories. I think Pam Sargent had a piece in there. I know George...
Did Barry Malzberg have one where a guy was hiding inside the Ark?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
I don't remember the title of it.
Yeah.
And he was punished or something. They punished him.
Yes.
Very odd.
And so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So anyway, so getting back to our conversation here, where I'm mm-hmm. giving away all my secrets that I tried to teach people, but this is...
giving them all away for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I it's not like I ever charge. But on the other hand, I get paid in ego, you know, just like the radio show. It's how we're paid at WBAI.
We're paid
in ego.
Yes, next time I order a pizza, I'm going to pay in ego.
Well, first you have to brush the ego off your pizza.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the work that we do here at WBAI is unpaid work. And some of the other work that I'm doing is virtually unpaid, but that's another issue. But we get paid in the thanks. We get paid in the idea that we've shared, that we've done something good. It is, as Lister would say, a... No, close. A mitzvah. You were close.
Yeah.
You knew the answer. You just didn't.
Yes.
I put you on the spot. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But it's a mitzvah.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I'm not kidding, Matt. He would know.
It's my roots.
Yeah.
It is.
I'm not going to make roots jokes, but horseradish are roots. Anyway, Well, but in terms of, I mean, I also teach microphone style and stuff like that. I cover, you know, some of the territory that Mary Robinette Kowal also does.
Mm-hmm.
But what she does is acting. She does voice training and all that. I do other tricks. I do, you know, you can do a character like, now I'm one character, now I'm another character. And I didn't change my voice at all. All I did was speak out of a different part of the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet... depending on the kind of mic that you're using, that changes the voice. And if you can just add a little inflection on that and say, now I'm a character, and now I'm a character, it's two totally different voices in the headphones, even though to the person in the room, this would not work at KGB.
Right, I'm thinking more of reading in front of an audience.
Which is another skill set as well. And even there, a great way to change characters is read one line, look at the audience, read the next line, look at the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Or just incline your head a little bit to the left for character A and a little bit to the right for character B. And if you're using a PA microphone, there will be a very subtle difference in the sound, but also to the people watching. Although I noticed tonight when Rick Bowes was reading, Ellen Kushner wasn't watching. She had his book. She was just reading along. I've done that. But at any rate, just watching the person performing and just the slight inclination of the head will make for a different character. So you have character one, character two, narrator. And each one of them will have a different... When I use the word attitude to the microphone, I'm using it like when they talk about the attitude of a plane,
you know,
the yaw and the pitch and all that stuff, that you just approach the mic, literally approach it slightly differently. It makes for a different character. And now, on the other hand, I mean, I have been listening to a great deal of some great, great narrators and great voices. Stefan Rudnicki, who read your story, being one of them. And I've got to edit a story that he read tomorrow, as a matter of fact. That's what I'm doing all day tomorrow, outside of my shrink. And which is a very necessary part of my life, which anybody at WBAI should know. But before I had that gig, I worked for Reader's Digest, believe it or not. This is 25 years ago. They put out audiobook versions of their magazine. Boy, was that pablum. Boy, was that just, you know, stories with their guts cut out of them.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Robert Sheckley story, Shape, a story that I love. And it was semi-censored. It's a really banal story in its way, but it was semi-censored because the lead character dares to live his own life rather than do what the authoritarians tell him to do, which is the point of the story. But anyhow, James Earl Jones.
Well, of course.
I mean, and he would say, how long should this be? We needed 29 minutes and 30 seconds. I don't think he ever looked at the clock. I think there was one point where he held up a finger so that he could, like, you know, sip some water, clear his throat, and went back and gave me 29:30, one take. It's like, oh, my God. So I've had experience with some great voices. And, of course, the very first person that I worked for at WBAI, Baird Searles, had a gorgeous voice. Gorgeous voice. He did the production. He was the reader for my production of The Council of Elrond. And I call that a production, even though it was one reader.
He did all the voices.
He did it all.
Wow.
And in The Council of Elrond.
Yeah. What is there, about 12?
At least,
right?
I mean, because you have to remember that so much of it is flashback. We're not talking the movie here.
That's right, in
which the council is 3 minutes long.
Mm-hmm. A lot of history revealed in that scene.
Yeah, because the movie is linear. And all the stuff that is revealed in the chapter of the Council of Elrond is told in flashback.
Mm-hmm.
But in the movie, it's told in real time. Now Gandalf goes and finds Saruman. And now, actually, the movie totally cut out Radagast, so they made up for it by putting Radagast in The Hobbit, where he just does not belong. But anyway, in the book, we hear all about Radagast, we hear about Saruman and all that, then it is revealed who Strider is. Then, and here is the sword that was broken. All that stuff comes together in that one chapter. And then, of course, the incantation of what is written in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
In Orc. And so one of the great, great, great glories of my life is that Baird had to deal with how to, you know, the exact pronunciation of how to do this thing in Orc, and also get the final word, and how do you pronounce Gandalf, one of the main characters in there. So he gives me a phone number, because I have access to the long-distance phones.
Right.
And tells me to call Oxford University and ask this person the pronunciation. So I was on the phone with Professor Tolkien.
And how is it pronounced? It's Gandalf? Wait.
Yes. You have it exactly correct. Yeah. He said Gandalf. And it's like, I couldn't do it. And he said it rhymes with half, as in half a sixpence.
Oh, Gandalf.
Okay, so, yeah, half a sixpence. Thank you, mister. Mm-hmm. I was raised in South Africa and now live in the Midlands. You know, and I'm an Oxford Don. What kind of, you know, if I saw Tolkien on TV, I would need subtitles. You know, like half of the British TV shows I want.
Or Hoff, yes.
Oh, Hoff.
Yes.
Exactly. Gandalf, if you're, you know, a Pythonian or something.
Yeah.
But it rhymes with half.
Gandalf. Yeah.
But half in a very British way. The Ozhnog. I can't do it. It's difficult to do the whole one ring to rule them all in Orcish, in the language of Mordor. I had to put Baird on the phone for that, but I couldn't give up. I mean, I was on the phone with Tolkien. You think I'm going to hang up on that call?
All right, thanks. Talk to you later.
Yeah. Sure thing, prof.
Yeah.
It says here.
Yeah, right.
What are you doing later, JR?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was just like... And Baird knew he was doing that to me. He didn't tell me who I was calling. He just said this.
Who did you think you were calling when he...
I was calling...
Oxford University. Oh, he just gave a number.
He gave me a number and he said, there's a person at Oxford University who will know. Here is his number.
Mm.
That's all the mother told me. That's all. Where's the list, Lister? We usually have the list of the seven words.
Yeah.
It's blocking the camera.
It is? It was here last week, because that way I could say it was number 5.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that assumes people listening have a cheat sheet.
Yeah. No, number 4.
Mm.
And it's
4 and a half.
So it's number 4.
4 and a half.
No. The whole word. Both parts.
Oh.
Both the family part and both the noun and the verb. It was one of those two words that had a noun and a verb. So, anyway. Both men are long past. I shouldn't speak. Baird had an amazing voice. He really did. And the problem is I would play that every year at 5 a.m. And I would get these complaints from listeners saying, I can't listen to that, not fall asleep. It is so lulling that they go to sleep and they have these dreams of Rivendell. You know,
it's not a bad dream to have.
No, it's not a bad dream to have, but he would just lull. He would pull them in, and he'd have all the characters there, and people would fall asleep. And this goes to something that we were talking about earlier, is that I have my vision of the Council of Elrond, and that one has stuck with me because I worked on that radio production.
Mm-hmm.
But so many other people have the very bad special effect of John Rhys-Davies as a dwarf.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big man, John Rhys-Davies. That's the one special effect they never got right. is whenever they showed the entire Fellowship of the Ring, the idea that this 6-foot-tall man was a dwarf, he never quite fit in with the rest of the group. They never quite got that perfect whenever they showed him ensemble. The first perspective, you know, the Ian McKellen versus...
Maybe it's just because you knew he was tall. I didn't notice.
No, I know.
I mean, I'll look again next time.
Watch it again. I treated myself to a guilty pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
I got the extended Blu-ray edition. And watched the whole extended version in 3 nights.
It's about 12 hours, right?
13. Yeah. I loved it. I have a lot of problems with that movie. But I had such a gleeful time watching it. I have to do it again with the narration, you know, the...
The voiceovers? The commentary?
Yeah, and there's two sets of commentaries and about 5 hours of specials.
I watched the, on the first disc, where they go into the, was it Weta Works? Weta Works? The company that did the special effects?
Weta.
And that was
probably
almost as long as the film and just as fascinating.
Yeah.
The history of, you know, they researched all this clothing and how they, you know, they made the chainmail out of little pieces of plastic that looked like metal and just so it wouldn't really be heavy and...
Yeah, and I had Jim Rigel on the show, who won, who's the head of WIDA. And I once actually had a number of people on WIDA on the show in the middle of editing Return of the King, because, hey, middle of the afternoon in Australia, guys.
Yeah.
So it was no problem for them. You know, I was 5 a.m., and it was, you know, like 3 p.m. or something like that over in... I don't know where they were, Melbourne or some place like that. And so they were on a speakerphone. It was
New Zealand, weren't they?
I'm sorry, New Zealand.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same accent. But anyway, to my ear.
All right, let's hope no Australians and Kiwis are listening.
No, Kiwis are Aussies. Right. Kiwis versus Aussies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to talk to an Aussie tomorrow. But anyway, the I had a lot of problems with that film. The missing of Sharky's End, the missing of the Raising of the Shire.
I see why they cut it out. It makes sense to me.
I understand why, but the reason that Tolkien wrote the book, there was no metaphor. There was no, everybody was assuming that there were all these different reasons, this analogues that Tolkien was writing. There wasn't any such thing. There was one thing Tolkien was saying, and it was, this is going to go away. This way of life, this beautiful, idyllic, practically 19th century Oxford, lovely Arcadian gardens. They're not going to be here. And it is largely technology.
Right.
That is going to undo it.
Technology, industry, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And war.
Right.
And no matter how innocent you are, war is going to affect you. You may not be seeing war right here.
It really brought Frodo's personal story to completion when he has to face that, like his own sanctuary is destroyed. The film...
it's not the point of the film.
Yeah, I see what they were trying to do in the film.
So do I.
They tried to do it without destroying the Shire. Didn't work. Although, I thought the scenes when they do come home and... They're sitting in the bar.
Yeah. I know. And everyone's dancing
and they're looking at each other. That was one of the most moving scenes in the film.
It really is. They have been through all of this and nobody knows, nobody recognizes.
I mean, obviously, the scene, I think most people's favorite scene for me is when they bow to the king and the king goes, no.
Yeah.
You know, we should bow to you. And then the whole kingdom bow. That,
and that's not in Tolkien. That was a Peter Jackson or whoever wrote Philippa Boyens or whoever wrote that moment in the script did that. And they did it beautifully.
That's not in the book?
Not as I recall, but I could be wrong.
I seem to remember that, but, you know, it's been a while since I read...
Same here.
I read Return of the King, so...
Yeah, I reread The Hobbit recently, and that got me a little bit angry at that movie.
Yeah, the movie was... I don't know. There were parts of it that were okay, but...
There was an hour of that film that was great. The other 2.5
I liked all the scenes in Bilbo's house. I thought those were great.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, Tolkien wrote those.
Yeah, I mean,
what is Radagast doing in a, you know, with snow bunnies running this, you know, this plow?
They came to Peter Jackson. They said, "We need you to turn this book into a trilogy." And he's like, "All right, I'm just going to pull this and pull this and pull that there, and let's just extend this."
And what's more, I want a Doctor Who in the movie.
What do you mean?
Radagast is played by Sylvester McCoy.
Oh, right. Okay.
The Eighth Doctor.
Right.
Excuse me, the Seventh Doctor. Paul McGann was the Eighth Doctor.
I didn't recognize him, but now that you say that, it makes total sense.
Well, I recognize him in the credits.
Right.
It's like, oh, no, Sylvester McCoy. So that's how I recognized him. I just saw Sylvester McCoy in something. He looks great.
Yes.
The other doctors, well, we'll see in the 50th anniversary special that some of the other doctors are not quite up to.
Are you watching the new season?
Yes.
What's your thoughts on it so far?
I thought the third episode... The one in the submarine... was decent and had...
Cold War, I think it was called.
Cold War. Had a feel of old-time Doctor Who and was a good episode despite being written by Mark Gatiss.
Nick Kaufman liked it. I read his blog review of it.
Now, ask me about the first two of the season. Or other don't.
What do you think of the first two of the season, Jim?
To quote one of my favorite critics... K. Tempest Bradbury. It really sucked. No, it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't good.
Yeah.
Okay? Too much coyness. Too much cuteness. They're pulling, and by the way, they're pulling a lot out of Cage Baker. Mm-hmm. I hope those who know Cage Baker's work, she's one of my favorite writers. Have you ever read the company novels by Cage Baker?
No.
You would like them. If you like Rick Bowes' writing, you'll like Cage Baker. Cage Baker has a character, this time travel stuff, who meets her lover and he is killed at the stake. He turns up again near the end of book 2 and is killed. And when he turns up in book 3, you're going, okay, something weird is going on here. And they're pulling that with Oswin, Clara, whatever, and all that. And you know what? She's not a bad companion. And what I liked about the third episode is that she was simply a companion, that it was good. There was an awkward moment where they hugged, and even then they were both a little bit awkward about it.
Yeah.
And they pulled away, and that was okay by me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm with you in the sense that I don't like that the companion is more than, like, it is something ethereal and mysterious, and there's, I mean, maybe it's just I don't like the way that they're developing it.
I say bring back Wilf. I thought Wilf was a great companion. Donna's father.
Right.
Grandfather, rather. Bernard Cribbins. I mean, why do we have to make them younger and younger until...
Oh, well, that's obvious. I mean, that's just the audience. They're yeah.
But the audience, it was always a kid's show, and it's still supposed to be a kid's show.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it have to be now that the doctor's companion is a potential bedmate? And it's either pining for the doctor and he doesn't recognize it, or he's pining for her.
Mm-hmm.
Usually her. Wasn't quite clear on Captain Jack Harkness. There was an ambiguity there.
There was an ambiguity, and there was something I don't remember if it was in Torchwood or Doctor Who where they said, oh, in the 56th century, no one cares about sexuality, you know, who you're, like, there's no distinction between, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it was in one of them, but it's in The Doctor Dances.
Yeah.
Where Rose is so besotted
mm-hmm.
with Captain Jack.
Right.
And when they've saved Jack's life, spoilers, and when they save Jack's life and bring him in, she says, oh, well, you know, of course he's got to have a good time. He's got to dance. And she, and even more. And she puts out her arms, and Chris Eccleston says, yes, but with whom?
Mm-hmm.
So there's just that bit of Russell Davies, metrosexual ambiguity. I guess it's tardosexual.
Tardosexual.
ambiguity.
Yeah.
That was thrown in there that I really liked. But outside of that, we have to go from Rose and the Rose crush until she finally ends up with her own cloned doctor that she can live in a separate universe with. Then we have to go to Freema, I don't know how to pronounce her name properly, Agreeman,
mm-hmm.
Martha.
Right.
Who
I liked quite a bit.
She's a great character. Yeah. But why do they have to make her pine for him so much and he doesn't notice? That was like, you know, come on. You know, you'll do just fine. And then they end up giving her an action hero some episodes later. Then Donna. Donna is the one character that he doesn't have to have a thing with. Mm-hmm. And what do? They give her the Superman kiss of forgetfulness.
Oh, I'm sorry. Donna was, of the new reboot of Doctor Who, I think she was, to date, my favorite companion. I meant Donna, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I would be willing to venture a guess. And then we go to the Ponds.
Mm-hmm.
And they played wonderful
stuff.
They
started off really strongly. And then
that first season with the Ponds was wonderful.
And then they started doing hellish things to her character.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked Rory, but then I kept saying to myself, why is he putting up with her?
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, 2,000 years, man, you know, like, she really hasn't been nice to you, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just so much loved that one season.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed. I did an interview with Connie Willis.
Yes.
And I liked her time travel stuff a little bit more than you. Probably because I was more interested in the Blitz
and
things like that. And Willis, she takes you into that place. And she makes you live there for many, 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 many words,
mm-hmm.
for many pages. And I was sort of okay with that, to just live there for a long time.
Right.
You, as I recall, I believe we had this conversation sometime back, not as much. You saw what was good in it, but you also were a little impatient to, can we get on with the story here, if I'm correct.
Which one are you talking about? The
Blackout.
Blackout. I actually have not read Blackout. You might have been talking with somebody else.
Oh, maybe so.
Yes.
Maybe so. But
I'm familiar with the book, but I haven't read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that trilogy. I mm-hmm. love that trilogy. And if people say it's too long, I say, well, it's at the pace at which she wrote it. But everything she writes, even no matter how teary some of her stuff may be,
mm-hmm.
is based on romantic comedy. And I was absolutely amazed, given the time travel stuff and everything that she did in that particular trilogy, to discover that she had never seen Doctor Who.
Really?
I did an interview with her the year that she was the guest of honor at Capclave.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually just went to the con suite, and I set up my little portable mic, and we just sat around the table, and people joined in, and they were, you know, asking questions. It actually worked out very well. And that one season with the Ponds, which starts out with Amelia Pond and all that, and then ends up with everything. Yes, there are problems with Rory in the 2,000 years, but still the whole business down to and including shooting off the Fez and the romantic comedy with River Song, and then finally it ends with a wedding and something old, something new, referring to the Doctor, something borrowed because something he blue. Stole the TARDIS,
right.
Something blue, and the universe is reborn as the Doctor comes out and we have a wedding and a dance, and the whole thing comes full circle and we see her entire life. I just thought, what a wonderful skiffy romantic comedy.
Yeah, I mean, the greatest moments of Doctor Who are often the comedic moments, I think.
Yeah.
The science fiction can also be amazing, but there's something really great about doing melding science fiction and comedy. I mean, Douglas Adams, you know, a show like Red Dwarf. Some of the episodes of Red Dwarf are some of the best science fiction.
The older episodes?
Yeah, the older episodes.
I'm sorry, but some of the new ones.
The new ones,
done it
the the most recent series. Just there were some laughs, but didn't really have the energy that the early ones.
My
did.
Favorite episode, I think, is the third episode.
Of
Red Dwarf? Yeah, of the first season of Red Dwarf, I think. Whichever episode it is, whichever number it is,
mm-hmm.
it's the one in which they're going through a slow time in space. So any number.
You mean like every episode?
But characters are being multiplied so that there's like five cats and five Listers. Oh, hi, Lister. Have you ever watched Red Dwarf? Because you know that. You know about Lister, right, Lister?
No, I do. Just joking.
You're hopeless. It was great science fiction. I actually mm-hmm. compare it to one of the stories by Stanislaw Lem.
Oh.
In one of the Perks of the Pilot stories, this great comedy in which a person knocks his earlier self out on the head in anger at himself and the various things with the cat. And in some ways you remind me more of the cat than you remind me of Lister. it's a character issue. But anyway, yes, I agree with you. There were some great science fiction moments in mm-hmm. Red Dwarf.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the one I think it's called The Inquisitor, where this robot lives to the end of time, discovers that there's no meaning to existence, so he decides that he's going to travel through time and determine who's not worthy to live and erase them from existence. And of course, you know, he comes to the Red Dwarf crew and decides to erase all of them from existence. They have to defend themselves before a judge, and who is their judge? Themselves. So they have to go up against themselves.
Oh, that's very existential.
Yeah, that's very cool. I like that. Yeah.
I like that a lot. I don't remember that one.
Oh, it's a good one.
Yeah, that isn't on Netflix, is it? The series.
I think some of them may be. I think recently they were put on.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. I mean, the problem with Netflix, the great thing about Netflix, and the problem with Netflix, and this, which is what I think is going to represent so much television viewing in the future, is the concept of binge watching.
Mm-hmm.
That when they, for example, we were talking before we got here about the American version they did of House of Cards,
yeah.
With Kevin Spacey. And what did they do? They released all 13 episodes in one day. They released them all at once. And a good number, some people, just binged. They watched the entire series within 2 weeks. So I've watched 2 episodes, and at some point I'll watch a third.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it will happen that we are sitting at home, my partner and I, and we'll watch a particular show. It might be Red Dwarf. It could be Vera. Excellent series. It could be any number of things. And we'll sit back and we'll say, let's do another.
Yes, I've done that.
And the idea that I have never watched I've watched one episode of Fringe, and it didn't do a lot for me, but that was probably because it was the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And pilots can have their problems and don't necessarily really represent where a series is going to go. And then I heard all these very interesting things about the show as it goes on. And so the day will come, or the week will come, where I'm going to binge on Fringe. I'll do the series in a month. Do 5 seasons in a month. Why not a show a night?
There were days where I watched about 5 or 6 Buffy episodes in a row, maybe more.
Okay, I call that restraint.
Exactly.
Yeah, easy to binge on Buffy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It really is. Angel, well, not so much.
Netflix,
but Buffy
now has this thing, after about 1 or 2 episodes, they pop up and say, "Are you still watching? We just want to make sure, you know, are you
really
still alive?"
I haven't had that.
Oh yeah, they'll after about 2 or 3, you get a little pop up. Sometimes it's right in the middle. It will ask you if you're still watching. It's kind of like what Pandora does.
Oh, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've done a thing recently that I find very curious, especially for watching something with very short bits like Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
Where they will, if you just let it run, it'll bypass the opening credits and get right to the next episode. So that as one episode ends, then you'll immediately get William Conrad saying, "Last time, if you remember, in Frostbite Falls." And they've perfect continuity.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't always work, but when it does, it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, that's, I think, between that and Aereo, that's what's scaring the networks. Aereo, because you don't need a TV to watch that stuff. Assuming the legalities of it hold up, you can just, you know, use any device to watch broadcast TV legally. Mm-hmm. And number two, the concept of Netflix, which will no doubt become reflected on Hulu and YouTube and the rest of them, that entire series will come out in one day, and you're not going to have the old Fox canceled us on the 3rd episode problem.
Right.
Joss Whedon.
Well, I love the idea that Netflix is producing their own series now.
Like, yeah.
The House of Cards, the American version, was a Netflix production.
That's right. That was their second. The first one was Lilyhammer,
right,
which I've yet to watch. And there's one that's starting sometime this week that's a horror show.
Really?
Yeah. Which I'm not necessarily that much into horror.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if I'm necessarily going to be watching that. But then they're going to be doing, they picked up new episodes of Arrested Development.
Yes, I heard about
this. They're doing a new season of a show that was canceled.
Are they ever doing that movie? I heard they were going to do a movie, but they have to through 5 years of history.
You see, I don't know. I have never seen Arrested Development.
You have never seen it?
Well, I've just started binging.
I think it's the funniest TV show since Seinfeld.
I fell off the sitcom wagon about the time of Seinfeld. I liked the first season of Seinfeld because it still resembled his stand-up comedy. But I also picked up on something that I think it took a lot of other people a little while to, which is I don't like any of these people.
No, they're all unlikable.
The point. Yeah,
yeah.
And I've got a.
Have you seen the finale?
Yes.
Then you know.
This. Yeah. But the point is that I picked this up by the beginning of the second season, and it took other people like I don't know how many meals at Tom's restaurant,
right,
or how many soup Nazis before they caught on to some of the gags. And, you know, maybe someday, I don't know why there hasn't, I grew up on sitcoms. I'm a generation before you. So my shows were Get Smart and, you know, the Buck Henry, Mel Brooks shows and stuff like that. Other people, I was just at a trade show event the other day for computers where they show various things. And they had Shirley Jones autographing pictures there. In fact, there's a picture of me on Facebook with Shirley Jones. And all these people were there. And they're all going, oh, I love the Brady Bunch. It's my favorite show and all that. And I was online to get my autograph picture. And I said, I said, I loved you in Elmer Gantry, where she plays a woman and turns into a prostitute. You know, not quite the same, you know, sweet mom image. But I said, and thank you for Oklahoma. And thank you for Carousel. And thank you for all the Rodgers and Hammerstein and all that. And she just looked at me and she looked less tired because everybody was like, you know, these middle-aged people coming up to this woman and saying, I watched you when I was a little kid. Which, of course, I did as well, but I think I had a little more tact in saying that. And I thanked her for her Broadway work and her classy work rather than just the Brady Bunch. But all these people grew up in the Brady Bunch.
Mm-hmm.
That was their show. I didn't. I think I was too old for it. Because I was like already 15 or something. I think it was a show for 8-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
At 15, I was working here for 2 years. God help me. Oh. Speaking of which, oh my God!
We're out of time, aren't we? Almost.
Almost. Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I should have started my theme, except for the fact that I've lost. Where's the damn thumb drive? I don't
just plug in your thumb.
I have my thumb here. I don't have the receptacle for it. The hub is gone. So I don't have any outro lister. Oh, what Max? You know where it is?
What?
Where's the hub?
What do you mean?
The hub.
What hub?
To plug in the USB.
That one right there? Or on top of the computer?
There's one on top, Jim.
There's four on top.
Ah, all the way up there. You put
there's
it.
There's one right there.
Behind I'm the street. Blind.
On the side of the rack.
Okay, here's the rack.
The other side of the rack.
The other side. Ah, it's been mounted. As hey. It should have been all along. It used to be right here.
Yes. It still is.
Oh, no. On the ground. Jesus, don't give a guy his Diablo 3 and he goes all over you. You'll never get past the level 2, boss! My guest this morning has been Matthew Kressel. We didn't discuss any of what we should have, but that's sometimes some of the fun, because I think that we had fun with the show nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly did. But this was the Come Keep Jim Company show. And we're going to do more Altered Fluid show, but I need to have, this is something we've never done and it's way overdue, is Matthew Kressel, science fiction writer, I'm going to read you a short story and we'll take calls about it show.
Okay. I'd love to do it.
So, you know, that's, and we shouldn't wait too long for that. There's no reason. It doesn't conflict with this at all.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to do an outro. And besides, I've been in your show for a minute already. Anybody listening to the podcast isn't even hearing this anymore. So it never happened. It's your show, Lister. Excuse me. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. My guest has been Matthew Kressel, who can be found online at matthewkressel.com.net. MATTHEWKRESSEL.NET or 5 Senses Press.
Thanks, Jim.
I'm at ourwolf.com. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister and No Cats. A river of spirit, and you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to spit it. I am a full of dairy. I am the fish. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Soda. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free.
American flag and burn.
Yeah.